From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. How does one acquire and develop a sense of beauty in art, a personal aesthetic of painting, sculpture, and related plastic arts? Soundings put those and other questions about art and art museums to two practicing art museum directors and art historians, Carl Nordenfalk and Peter Bowron. Carl Nordenfalk is an authority on Rembrandt and a scholar at the National Humanities Center, where he's writing an art history entitled The Five Senses in Art. He was for more than 20 years director of the National Museum of Art in Stockholm, Sweden, his native country. Peter Bowron is director of the North Carolina Museum of Art in Raleigh, North Carolina. The conversation begins now with comments from Carl Nordenfalk about notable changes in art museums in Europe and America over the last 50 years.
I think they may have changed like all museums in the world, they have become bigger, larger, and got more public, had perhaps even got a little more money, and that the collections have been steadily growing. I think in the 1930s, the museum was a place mainly for people genuinely interested in art and in culture. And we got very few people coming from other classes, other parts of the society. Whereas today, or since the last 20, 30 years, we have a much, much larger public than before.
How did that occur? Why did that occur?
I think it occurred for two reasons. One reason might be economic, that people have more money, frankly, and can dispose of their free time much more now than they did in the 1930s.
So it doesn't necessarily mean that you have a sanguine view about the interest in culture on the part of large publics.
Well, I think that follows a bit with the economic situation. Uh-huh. But then, of course, it has very much to do with what the museums are doing themselves in the way of attracting people. And there are two main possibilities open for any museum. One is to stage temporary shows of great interest, perhaps for the moment. And the other, and perhaps more important, is to do something in the way of education for the great public. And in that way, all European museums, and certainly those in my country, in Sweden, have learned a lot from the United States. The United States museums were pioneer in education already before World War II. And I remember that a colleague of mine, my predecessor, as a matter of fact, in the education department, he went over in the 1930s to the United States just to study that problem and brought back to Sweden a lot of great and interesting experiences.
Peter, what have American museums, what's been the position in terms of educating the public? What has been the function of American art museums?
Well, of course, American art museums have had that as a conscious goal since the 19th century. If you read the charters of the great Eastern museums, the Metropolitan Museum, Philadelphia, and Boston, there's inevitably a statement to the effect that the intention of the museum is to improve the general level of education, to raise the cultural understanding, the aesthetic appreciation of the masses. The wealthy and powerful men and women who brought these museums into creation had that very much as an intent, and I think it really issues naturally from 19th century premises of democracy.
Mm-hmm. And has that happened?
I think it has to a great degree. I think that the movement, as Carl said, one of the premises of American museums has always been to educate, perhaps to a much greater degree than has been the case in Europe, where I think the older values, the values of the 18th century and the early 19th century, or shall we say the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, as opposed to the early 19th century, to either create a wonder of natural and artistic treasures, as opposed to a means of really educating, of sharing them in a didactic way.
How do you get people to understand what goes on in an art museum?
I think I have one good recipe for it. if you want really to understand art, you should try to be get involved yourself in modern art, especially, or in art in general.
You mean become
as,
a painter?
As a collector, first of all, if you can afford it, and there are works of art which still aren't that that enormously expensive. And certainly if you know what is going on in modern art and you know young artists, for instance, you can both get good works of art for yourself and at the same time perhaps help a young artist on his way. My experience is that nothing is that good for education than to know artists and to talk to artists about art. They have a special approach to it, to which is genuine, and they very often are very good speakers too. Writers even are artists. So you shouldn't get discouraged in any way by what seems to be difficulties in modern art, abstract art or so on. There are so many different ways to approach art, and why shouldn't you find at least one that suits you? Trying to build up a personal experience in one way or another. You can do it in a museum, but you can also do it outside the museum. You can do it with dealers, for instance. In the smaller, big art galleries, you may encounter people who have a very good eye, a very good knowledge of what is going on. And that is educational experiences, as good as any talk in a museum.
Peter?
Well, I take the, as a museum director who's actively grappling with these problems, I'm concerned, first of all, of course, with presentation. I happen to believe that people need to be encouraged, induced, to focus upon individual works of art. For example, if I enter a gallery and I see people milling, if I see people walking, I know that they're not concentrating on individual works of art. Unless, of course, they're simply moving to look at another work of art. But when you're walking, when you're moving about, you're not concentrating, you're not making the effort to really apprehend or grasp anything special or anything particular about an individual work of art. And I do think that we need, as museum educators, to encourage people to respond to fewer works of art in a more substantial way.
Yeah, that's very true.
I'm less concerned about generalities about style or period than I am about when I'm teaching or when I'm encouraging the public to look, than I am about a particular work of art, its context. I think we must always move from the particular to the general, and to encourage people to go away just remembering even a detail of a great picture or a single bronze or a pre-Columbian pot that they happen to admire particularly is much more important than remembering the sequence of styles from the early Renaissance to Louis XV, for example.
Carl, how would you compare the museum goer of Europe in the 1930s and 40s with the museum goer today in the 1980s?
I think the museum goers today have been now accustomed to be taken care of as they enter the museum. Of course, partly by the written word, by catalogs, but also by guides to the museum. But what is most important and most people want to have is a direct guide telling them what to see and how to see. And that is the American system, I guess, which we imported as late as in the 1930s. Because Peter is quite right, it has a very old tradition in this country. In Europe, we had the belief that perhaps the really best approach to art is a very personal thing. If you don't see with your own eyes, you don't see very much at all. But that is not quite true, because people can be taught how to see. And that is the secret, of course, of the great educator, if he can do that.
I think here one of our first goals is to teach people that visiting a museum is a lifelong experience, that museums are places of change, that there are a variety of experiences, both visual, aesthetic, intellectual, and cultural.
The very word museum suggests permanence. It's frozen and You're suggesting the opposite.
Absolutely, because there are too many people that have told me over the course of my career, oh yes, you know, when I explain that I've worked in a museum, oh yes, I remember visiting the museum in the sixth grade, or my child visited it as if it were a once-in-a-lifetime experience. And indeed, I think that's one of our primary goals, is to teach. Museums are great repositories, like libraries. I mean, it's absurd for someone to say that he visited or he used a library on one occasion. Well, it's equally absurd to say that you visited a museum once. And I think that every technique in the arsenal of the museum educator, we hope to be able to put to our at our disposal for encouraging people to come back. And as Carl says, that also includes it includes guides, it includes self-instruction, it includes lectures, concerts, films, and alas, it includes a place to eat, a place to rest, it includes a museum shop, a place to buy. The one difference that I might comment on between the visitor of 1930 and the visitor today is, of course, in the 50 years, all of us have become enormously stimulated, whether we like it or not, by advertising. We are assailed by visual images that have nothing to do, and in fact, that actually compete against, that are antithetical to the experience of visiting a museum. When a child has been raised on a diet of 15-second commercials, it's very difficult to ask him to stand in front of a painting a stationary painting for 10 minutes to try to delectate, to absorb something, to find something.
Would you say that European audiences, Carl, are simply more sophisticated in terms of art and museums than American audiences?
No, I see no reason why there should be. There may be a living tradition, partly still alive in certain European capitals, but otherwise, I think we are all in the same boat. I see no reason to be proud of the European situation compared to the American.
Peter?
I used to, when traveling around Europe, I viewed European museums and their audiences with a certain wistfulness, believing that indeed Europeans were much more sensitive and were much more knowledgeable, grasped the context and the contents of the museums in their cities more firmly than their American counterparts, until I realized that I was seeing these museums in the great European capitals, in the great European cities. Visiting the Stedelijk in Amsterdam or the National Gallery in London is not quite the same thing as visiting the Toledo Museum of Art on a rainy Tuesday afternoon in Ohio, or the Columbus Museum of Art or the North Carolina Museum of Art. Because one of the things you learn early on is to analyze the demographic context in which a museum exists. So thus a museum in Washington or in New York or in Boston or Philadelphia, which have large urban populations, which there's the added leaven of enormous number of tourists, both national and international visitors, you just can't make these comparisons to local museums that depend largely, if not totally, upon local audiences.
Well, there is, of course, a great difference between the European museums as they were in the 19th century and the American museums of the same time. In 100 years ago, practically all the great masterpieces, or 90% of the great masterpieces, were in Europe. And what we have witnessed in the last in this century is an enormous exodus of great works of art from Europe to American museums. So that in certain fields, perhaps nowadays, the American museums are even more important than Europeans. The European Museum had, of course, a great advantage of being first to make the choice. They started already with the Royal Collections. But it's remarkable how the American Museum have been able to keep up with the situation. There are certain European people who think that it's a pity that so many works of art have left Europe and come over to the United States. I think quite the other way around, that the Americans are, after all, the descendants of Europeans, and so why shouldn't they have their share in the common European culture? ¶¶
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a conversation about art and museums of art in contemporary Europe and America. The speakers are Carl Nordenfalk and Peter Bowron. Carl Nordenfalk, an authority on Rembrandt, was director of the National Museum of Art in Stockholm, Sweden, for more than 20 years. He's a scholar at the National Humanities Center, where he's writing an art history entitled The Five Senses in Art. Peter Bowron is director of the North Carolina Museum of Art in Raleigh, North Carolina. Do you see a tension in what you do, running art museums, between the nature of art itself, which is, if not aristocratic, it is restricted to the relatively few, and do you see a tension between that and what you're doing with art, opening it to, you know, making it a democratic kind of thing?
I think that the great art collections in the world were really, to start with, born in a castle. They were for a very small, privileged group of people. And as they were given out to public use, the paintings, the collections, of course, didn't change themselves. And there is something still left in the great work of art of being a privileged person, which we always have to respect. Education is necessary and can give very good result, but it mustn't interfere with the quality or the work of art itself. That's very true what you said there.
How do you get over this tension?
Well, since the work of art is not going to change, it is the spectator who has to change. And some people are, when they come to the museum, in a way rather nervous. You know, they think that they have to stand a trial almost, whether they are good enough, whether they are intelligent enough, whether they are sensitive enough to understand what they're going to see. That situation is very common. It's a very human situation and has to be dealt with almost like a priest or a doctor that deals with his patient. There is, I think it's T.S. Eliot has said once, that there is a stage fright on both sides of the curtain, not only with the actors, but also with the public, who are afraid they won't understand what they're going to see or hear. And that is certainly always the case, but a thing which is so exciting to try to overcome if you are a good educator.
Peter?
I agree. There was once, I once talked to a man who in the late 60s was teaching a course at Hunter College in New York. He was an English professor, and he was teaching a course to what is sometimes called disadvantaged youths. And as an assignment, he asked them to go to the Metropolitan Museum over the weekend. And when they returned, when the class convened on Monday, he began to examine them and realized that only one or two had even gone to the museum. And upon questioning, he found that most of these students, I presume minority students, had lived in Manhattan, but perhaps in the Bronx or perhaps in other boroughs, had in fact gone to the Metropolitan at Fifth Avenue and 82nd Street, but were in fact afraid to climb up those stairs and enter that rather forbidding temple. It was an alien, it was a strange experience to them, and they simply didn't have they lost the nerve to do it. And I think that for many people, the aristocratic impulses that resonate around a work of art, that convey elitism, that convey wealth, that convey a rather specialized ownership, I think that that still lingers. And I think that most people of my generation, most museum people of my generation, would say, indeed, it must be abolished. I would like to transfer that awe. I still think that the experience of looking at art, there must be always a degree of awe. But the awe should be reserved for the work of art itself, not the packaging, not the museum, not these series of values, which in fact do antagonize a number of people, and they pass under the names of elitism. Mm-hmm. And that is why I think most museum educators and most museum administrators really do make that effort to break down those rather perhaps erroneous, but specialized set of assumptions and reserve them just for the work of art itself, not all the connotations that people have traditionally held.
So there is no necessary tension there.
Not at all, and that is why we go to such efforts to inform the public through guides, through handbooks, through extended wall labeling, through audio tours, in an effort to let them focus upon the work of art itself. That's why museums, the installations of museums are increasingly democratic. They're open, they're free, they use eye-catching materials. They're places, you know, the relationship between the museum and the shopping mall is, alas, one of increasing kindredness. And I think that ultimately that does work toward breaking down this sense of awe, as the museum is a place that is the reserve of only the special, the elite, the well-educated, the wealthy.
How do you view the public?
Well, I think I have always counseled myself to have enormous patience with the public, because the public, to a large degree, is their appetites are stimulated and controlled in this matter, as in other matters, by the marketplace, by photojournalism, by the media. And there are many people there's no question that when the glossy magazines and the television discovered art museums, that there was a latent interest in them when they discovered them. And I would say that occurred sometime around 1969, 1970. When the Metropolitan experienced its centennial, there's no question that people now are indeed manipulated by a handful of journalists, and that an exhibition which is billed as a blockbuster has a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy.
I think it's Schopenhauer who said something which I always remember. He said, when you stand in front of a great work of art, you should imagine that you are at the audience of a great king. You shouldn't start to talk until he starts to address you. And something like that you have to realize always, especially with the great masters, with the great masterpieces, that you should give the first word to the work of art before you open your own mouth.
Do you despair when you observe just the opposite occurring, or when you observe insensitivity or indifference or even hostility?
Of course I despair if I am the talker.
Is there such a thing as public taste? How do you gauge it? How do you figure out what to put in a museum?
Well, I think there is. I think that people in varying areas, I think that the taste has shifted enormously in recent years too. Not, when I say contemporary art, I don't mean the avant-garde, but to another decidedly local, parochial level of contemporary activity. And I know that I'm very careful now in the materials that we're producing for the opening of the new museum, frankly, to avoid images of the risen Christ and of the suckling Madonna, because I feel those images have been pushed for too long and are antithetical. And we are, for example, using on one of our posters, we're using a Frank Stella, a 1969 Frank Stella, which is recognizable, it's bold, it's bright. It happens to be a good picture, but I think it conveys a different image for my particular museum that is appropriate for this particular time.
Who pays for museums in Europe? Who pays for them in America?
In Europe, I think most museums, all the big museums nowadays, are paid for by the government, or in some cases still by the cities, communal museums. Whereas private institutions are very, very few. In the United States, the tradition is, of course, the other way around, that only now government steps in more than they did before. The American museums were entirely dependent upon the great wealth of private citizens to start with.
Absolutely. The museum I direct, the North Carolina Museum of Art, is, of course, an agency of the state of North Carolina, but in fact it was, it is not unique, but it is rare in America in that the money, the original money to buy the works of art came from the state of North Carolina from the General Assembly in 1947. But and that probably is unique. There are three state-run art museums in America. North Carolina has one, Virginia has one, and Florida has one. But all of the other institutions I've worked for, indeed, the money, the impetus, all came from private resources, and in some cases from private collectors, such as William and Henry Walters in Baltimore, whose collection became the city, became the Walters Art Gallery, although it is, in fact, they bequeathed it to the city of Baltimore.
Who is it, can I be just so blunt as to ask you, who is it that figures out what art is worth? How does a director approach that problem of acquiring what he feels is, he or she feels is best for a museum?
Well, there is no fixed price for a work of art. The work of art is worth that much that someone wants to pay for it at that very moment. And nowadays...
It's like the price of gold. It rises and falls.
Well, there's another problem with works of art, and that is the rarity value. As great museums now all over the world are filled up with masterpieces, there aren't that many left, and the few left in private possession get more and more expensive by the very fact that they are so few.
How would you characterize the world's supply of great art? It's finite, obviously.
Well, the supply of old art couldn't grow, except that you can make a few discoveries in unknown places. But the supply of modern art is, of course, always there. That's the great difference.
Except that I take a slightly more pessimistic view. If one looks at history, you see that mankind, that centers of civilization, that repositories for treasures, are constantly shifting over the map. Countries go broke, they are destroyed, they are overrun, and there's no reason to think that that won't continue. I mean, we have no export laws. There's nothing to say that only a fool would think that 50 years from now, institutions, American art museums, might not be selling their, particularly those that are run by the state, won't be selling their treasures to raise money for extraneous purposes. I see no reason to think that every work of art that's in the National Museum in Stockholm or in the Louvre or in the North Carolina Museum of Art is always going to be there. I mean, it would be folly to think otherwise.
Well, the great experience we have in that way was, of course, when the Soviets started to sell treasures from the Hermitage, as they did in the late 20s and the early 30s. And I know that the Russians themselves perhaps regret it now. They did it for economic, political purposes. They wanted hard currency and so on. But the prices they got, which sounded in those days astronomic, are today very, very low, very cheap.
And those museums that are most aggressive in acquiring today, we joked earlier about Westward the Course of Empire, are, of course, located in the Sun Belt, the museums that have the most money, that have the most leverage and clout to buy on the international art market, are in Texas and California and in the Southwest generally.
Carl Nordenfalk is a scholar at the National Humanities Center, where he's writing an art history entitled The Five Senses in Art. Peter Bowron is director of the North Carolina Museum of Art. You've been listening to Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. The center would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina 27709. Soundings is made possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities.